White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the webmaster, January 5th, 2017. This is an interview from 1999 with the Press Enterprise, a newspaper from the North San Diego County area. It's a longer interview, but it has many carryovers to today's events. So take a close listen to see how quite prophetic it can be.
I don't know if you'd be able to record over all the noise.
Yeah, I'll put it like this. It might help a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, these gals, boy. But I can't say too much. A lot of them are my customers.
And you still do, you're still in the TV repair business?
Even though it's a dying business.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, when TVs break today, people just throw them out.
VCRs. I mean, I've seen them as low as $70. In fact, that was last year. The bottom pretty much started dropping out. Well, there's a lot of other people in the same boat on foreign Chinese stuff.
Yeah.
Our wonderful globalist government.
So you must be, what, 60 or 61?
61.
61.
Yep.
And you're in great shape.
Well, I work out, intermittently and so forth. I think some of it you're just lucky with the right genes, too. My dad was always in pretty good shape, but he didn't really work out that much. But I do a lot. I'm very active, I'm always on the move.
You travel much, or do you stick pretty close to home?
I stick pretty much close to home. Some important things I travel that I feel are really important. Like, I spent a week in Japan about 6 months ago, making contacts with people that, Japanese nationalists. And national socialists in Japan, and also with a number of business leaders and even governmental leaders. I gave a lecture to, I'd say, 200 or 300 Japanese, mostly business and government officials and students. And I got to meet some very important people in Japan. They were curious of my input because they've got a lot of money invested in this country.
Really? And what'd you tell them?
I said, divest immediately. Because you're the biggest creditor country in the world, but just having paper in your hands don't mean a thing. You can't trust. And I said, you better arm yourself, too, because if China and Korea come at you and forget the United States, I don't think anybody who makes a treaty with the United States is usually gets screwed. And they like that straight out, sort of working class candor. I said, the more you invest in our country, the more you prop up what we consider our enemies. in Washington.
And what?
Our enemies, both racial and economic. Mm-hmm.
And that would sort of be the the government.
Well, it's the government, the bureaucracy, really, more than it's just a big bureaucracy with a lot of very wealthy people behind it, the transnational corporations, and of course I simply say that we're no longer a sovereign nation, that we have been led by the transnationalists into this world federation that simply sustains an elite class now around the world. Much of it is headquartered right here in this country. I don't believe removing one politician, putting another in, doesn't change anything. Because the bureaucracy just keeps going. I can't get into Europe. I can get in, but I risk going to jail. I'm on the Interpol list, and my son attempted to go with KFI over to Germany on a tour, and he was arrested at the airport and shipped back. And if I try to openly go into England or Germany or France, most of those countries, I would be at the least put on a plane and sent back, or at the most arrested and actually in prison.
And when did that happen to your son?
Well, that's been now about at least 5 years. I forget the exact year that happened. Bill Handel on KFI. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys, American media people, think that the doors everywhere just swing open, and and my son told them on the way over there, he said, I think we're going to have problems. Oh, don't worry about it, John. Don't worry about it, John. And when the aircraft came to a stop, John saw some guys in suits down at the end of the gangplank. John says, Bill, I think we're going to have problems. He said, get down to the end, they grab him, take him into a room, strip search him, try to question him for a couple of hours, and put two armed guards with him all the way back to Chicago. So if they did that to my son, you can imagine what they do to me. But on the other hand,
and why did they do that? Because of the fear over there of the neo-Nazi.
Yeah, and mostly it's fired by this by ADL and the Defamation League and people like that blow things so out of proportion that you would think I would be traveling with bombs in my briefcase or something. Where in fact all I do is go give a speech or talk to people. But I was arrested in Canada. Ironically, after I gave a big speech. I was picked up in Buffalo by a couple of Canadian friends, and we came to the border, and they asked, well, what were you out of the country for? They said we were shopping, which they were, but they picked me up, and they looked at me, and they didn't even ask me anything. We went right on in. So then when they arrest me, they accused me. They got this real weird law that if you do not tell them everything in your entire history that might have to do with being an undesirable or whatever, then you're guilty of a crime. Well, I could probably include about 80% of the people coming across the border.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was a funny deal, strange. Gave the big speech, and then driving through the park, going to a friend's house, and all of a sudden we saw the motorcade stop, and we saw these guys in black SWAT uniforms and automatic weapons run up to a car up ahead, and I said to John, somebody must have robbed a bank. And then somebody, up one of those SWAT fellows, pointed back to our car, and I said, uh-oh. They pulled us out of that car, threw us on the ground, and we were in suits, you know, and everything. And what really made him mad was John and I were laughing. What the hell is this? These guys had machine guns and everything, you know. Anyhow, they kept us there for 5 days. Jail. Of course, we were scheduled to leave the next day after they arrested. You know, that same day. We said, just let us go home. You know, oh no. So they went through all this big process and brought in the big shots from the government. And then they said, well, you know, if I ever want to go back to Canada, I got to give a special permission from the top guy in Ottawa, which they'll never give. So.
And
but I have stepped across the border a couple of times. Just to bug them.
And all through your life, you seem to have, in many ways, sort of forced the system to examine itself. You know, its free speech laws, its, you know, its right to assembly law. You know, the whole thing. So, I mean, that would sort of be an example of how you've, you know, you've sort of brought to light sort of a, you know, a law that might not be completely fair in that country. Is that, you know, is that part of what you
I enjoy twisting the tail. I've said before, I just simply hold a mirror up to the system and let it see how it really is. You know, when I was thrown out of the Democrat Party, or I was thrown off the County Central Committee, and I was thrown off the State Central Committee, of which I was democratically elected to, I referred to the Democrat Party as in San Diego as the Stalinist wing of the Democratic Party. And I mean, it's absolutely totally unconstitutional what they did. And if I'd have been somebody that's more PC or had another philosophy, I'd have had 15 attorneys suing them for everything they had. But when I have problems, I'm lucky to find an attorney. So they drug me off the Central Committee. I pretty much got the message that political parties are never going to make any reasonable change in this country, except for the worst.
Except for what?
For the worst. Well, I did run for U.S. Senate then in 82, which I did not too bad, considering there were about 8 or 9 of us running. What a crew. Gorbadal, me, Jerry Brown. However, I have a lot of respect for Gore Vidal. He might not like to hear that. I like a lot of his anti-imperialist writings and his speeches, which I usually record.
And
Edmund Brown Sr., the ex-governor, he's the only guy that ever, in the party of any stature at all, was decent to me. I met him at a cocktail party in Palm Springs, and he came up to me and said, "Tom, I think you got a great future in politics if you'll just forget this Klan thing. Which I was quite surprised.
So the why not move out of Fallbrook and go to, you know, the California, the, you know, the very soon, if not now, you know, whites will be in the minority. You know, the Aryan movement. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, you know, it's, as far as I think the people that, correct me if I'm wrong, but the people that sort of take it to heart is probably declining, whereas in other states that might not be quite the case. What keeps you here? What keeps you in California, or what keeps you in Fallbrook?
Well, first of all, I've lived here so long. I had six children and my wife, and we lived here so long, and I've had my business here. Yeah. And we like the weather here, and like that, but I disagree on the other points. California is the single biggest source of support and contributions for racism in the country. It always has been. And I think California and Texas and Florida is coming up strong. It's places where you have the most racial mixing to where you have the most racism. You don't have very much racism in Montana or Wyoming. Maybe a little bit, a few pockets, but because if you have basically a white population, there's not any need to be racist. Racism is sort of a inoculation, a protective idea that says, hey, watch out, you're being overrun, you know. And I want to be on the front lines here. I may have to be the last one out here with my flag and my and turn the lights out, but there was a story of the Roman soldier of Pompeii who had to break him out of a lava he'd been encased in because a Roman soldier never left his post. And this is my post, and as long as it's tenable, I'll be here.
The a lot of these, you know, the Klan rallies that you see across the country, or, you know, you see media coverage of them, and, you know, there'll be, you know, five or six people that come to the demonstration, and 100 or 200 that come out against it, and it, you know, it turns into a real, the demonstrators are almost have to fight for their lives to get out safely.
Right.
Have you ever had any incidents where, you know, you've just been anywhere where you bumped into the wrong person, or, I mean, you know, have you ever...
You mean individually or collectively?
Yeah. Well, either one.
I mean, you know, at Oceanside, California, in 1980, when I was running for Congress, we had a major riot.
Yeah.
We were about 25 of us went over there, and I was going to give a birthday speech for Andrew Jackson, the greatest... One of the greatest presidents we ever had. He brought the national debt to zero. He opened up the West for white colonization. And we were attacked by Marxist groups from all over the state. And we had to fight not only them, but then the police attacked us as we were leaving. So it was a strange combination. There were the Marxists and the cops both after us. But I have quite some time ago said that I don't believe in rallies anymore, and I essentially moved away from the right wing in 1980. And many right wingers call me a Bolshevik and a leftist, which a lot of my positions do come from the left. If they're a good idea, I don't care where it comes from. On economics and labor, you see a lot of my ideas coming from the left. A lot of people assume that I was a big right winger, and I was at one time. But I didn't support Ronald Reagan in either time he ran. I opposed the intervention in Central America. I opposed the invasion of Grenada, I believe it was. And I opposed the Contra thing. I opposed all these excursions around the world that we should not be involved in. So we make a distinct division between us and the traditional right wing. We call ours the revolutionary struggle, and the right wing are still the pretty reactionary types as far as we're concerned, and they are the ones that go out and march around in the street and get people throwing things at them and so forth, which is ridiculous. If I couldn't go in the streets without enough power to enforce my will, I wouldn't, and have the police protect me, I would never go. It's an insult, degrading.
Yeah. I know, that's sort of my impression.
Oh, it makes you think it looks that way to you. It drives us up the wall when we see that stuff. Number one, times when they're attacked, they'll have run. Well, no situation I've ever, we never ran. We stood and fought. We were outnumbered in Oxnard, California in 77. We were attacked by the Progressive Labor Party. We were outnumbered about 10 to 1. We fought it out and almost destroyed the community center up there, or they did. It was a major war. And then at Oceanside, and then we were attacked at the border a couple of times. I have told these people on the other side, I said, well, fine, we'll come anytime you want to ask something, but just tell the cops to stay home. Let's just have it straight on and see what happens here. But they never do that. They always want the cops to know. But anyhow, I don't feel like it's productive to roll around in the dirt with some pseudo-Marxist or whatever, so the system could just grab you both and throw you in the can, you know. That don't gain anything. The fastest growing Aryan situation is the young college kids that are not skinheads and don't go around in uniforms. They don't go to meetings and they don't put tattoos on and so forth, and they're burrowing themselves in, you know, and that's what I've promoted for a long time. The faction that's on the street is just a very small percentage of the overall association. I was a guest speaker at the National Alliance a meeting in Detroit this year. In fact, last year too. And he had a place full of businessmen and people, almost all of them in suits and military men and everything.
Would you say it's the college students because of, you know, they see, like, it's because of affirmative action, or it's because of, you know, just their, you know, growing up in more of a multiracial society, or would you see that?
Nothing creates a racist like conditions that surround it. Blaming people like me for creating racist falls short of what's really going on. Society itself and the actual day-to-day problems people run into is what creates racism. And then some will then contact me and say, well, now I know what it's like and I agree. Can you send me a newspaper or whatever? But it's not, we don't have the means to reach everyone in the public to really come to our class and we'll teach you how to be a racist. No, they're getting it on the job, they're getting it in the schools. This one-sided approach where school administrators are scared to death to be called racist, and so I get all kinds of mail where if there's a tiff between a white and a non-white kid at school, the white kid almost always gets the shaft. The whole hate crime thing is doing more to create racists than it is to stop racists. And it was insane.
You mean by sort of singling it out, making a media issue of it?
It's the best thing that ever happened to us as a more radical group. Because it drives more and more people to be more radical because they see the unfairness, the unjustness of it. I mean, if you hit a black guy in the nose, and if you have ever been a member or received a newspaper or any pro-white group, immediately it's a hate crime. If you should happen to call him a nigger or whatever in the process, it's a hate crime.
Yeah.
But if he beats the hell out of you, it's simple assault. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and the same way with illegal aliens. If I go out here and punch an illegal alien, he's protected by the federal government, and that's a federal crime. But if he punches me, it's just assault. So, I mean, you know, it don't take long for people to catch on.
And
then they throw these kids in, or whoever, in prison. And then they really get... you think that they're violent before they go in. They come out to a lot more violent. Because they're in there, they're forced to divide and to survive.
Take sides.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just get pushed into situations where they got to collect and defend themselves. So you get the Mexicans with Familia Nostra and Mexican Mafia, and you got the Black Guerrilla Family. You got all the black groups, the Muslims. And then you get the Aryan Brotherhood, and then you've got a lot of other white groups.
What do you see your role in all this? You're getting older,
Yeah.
You're
I've planted.
Have you mellowed, Eddie?
No. The government won't let me mellow.
Really?
And I've often said this. If the government doesn't like me, why did they create me? Because everything, every reason that I'm more radical has come from something that some area of the government or some special interest group has caused. Before the trial in Portland, Oregon, I was pretty radical, but I was still not, you know, maybe by everybody else I was very radical, but by my own. But after that trial, I certainly became much more radical. And after the being dragged off the Central Committee of the Democrat Party, it's been a, and then I fought with the IRS early on during the Vietnam War. I refused to pay my income taxes. Each one of these is like steps on a pyramid that have moved me more radical, moved me also out of the right wing, and began to recruit a lot of leftists too into what we're doing, and moved me into the international situation with, oddly enough, the Japanese and South and Central American whites, and opened up our contacts within Russia but I see myself as a Johnny Appleseed. I've been planting my seeds for a long time, and now a lot of the teenagers that I dealt with years ago are now, you know, they're career people and family men and so forth. And a lot of them have retained and streamlined their ideas. So if I quit right now, I would have done my job, because there's a new crop of young leaders coming on, and believe me, they'd have been better off to deal with me than they are going to be with these guys. There's a new study out that just came out back east, a gigantic study on the race situation that I was listening to talk about it on the radio. It underscores, in fact, Bill Handel talked about it the other day, it underscores that the race thing has not changed at all, really. Everything's moved into code words and everything else, you know. So, and my friends that are either military or ex-military, some of them have written books about how the United States is balkanizing, and the Southwest will.
What does that term mean?
Well, you know, like in the Balkans,
I see. It's split into different factions.
That's what's happening in this country. The Southwest, the way it's going now, will be overrun by the Mexicans and other mestizos. I don't call them Hispanics, because we have white Hispanic people also. Mestizo is the non-white. And like this town, we'll go Mexican. And there'll be a few.
But it already is, but to a
to a degree, yeah. And the businesses start going that way. But there'll be a few rich white guys still hanging on with their little compounds up on the hill. And whites have been moving out of here a lot. And the only whites that are coming in here is people who are coming in here from places that are worse.
They come here and they think, oh, isn't this a beautiful little country town?
Yeah, compared to Orange County and L.A. County. And of course, Temecula and that area is nothing, becoming simply a little L.A. People try to, whites try to escape all the so-called crime in Los Angeles and Orange County. That's another code word for non-whites. And now they follow them right wherever they go, they follow them. So they have the same problems over there as they will in L.A. But the problem is that people are in denial. even if you don't like the truth, you got to face the truth of what's happening. And that's where I get in trouble, because people want me just to shut up. And they think, a lot of people think that this nirvana of getting all the races together and we'll just get along wonderful, and when Whitey's out of here everything will be fine. That's ridiculous, because the latest studies in L.A. show that the most racist groups are the blacks and the Mexicans against each other, and sending people around to try to rent an apartment, sending blacks into a Mexican neighborhood, and they're telling them they don't have anything to rent. So racism is not going to end, even if the white man totally went back to Europe.
So the
I speak to the Mexican press now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, if you want Southern California, if we're going to give it to you, then we'll give it to you back the way we found it. Be either scorched earth and turn off the water. Yeah. So we come in here and build this up and develop it, and now you want it back? I tell them, no water, no people.
So the with your situation, there was the judgment, the Portland judgment.
It's about $10 million, I think.
Yeah, and some of the stories in this packet have talked about how you paid like $100,000, or it was $100,000.
My house.
Right, it was your house and
my
tools.
Business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I never had much money. My wife and I, you know, because she took care of the family while I worked, and I don't think we ever took in over $30,000 in a year and that I can ever recall. Of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center that was suing us, they tried to build up some ridiculous story that I was taking in a couple of $100,000 a year. My wife and I used to look at each other and say, wow,
where is it?
We could have been living in Fat City with $200,000. No, I was a symbol, and they set me up as a symbol, and they threw everything they had at me, including perjury and suborning witnesses and suborning perjury, everything they had. I'll take a lie detector, and my son will any time about that. What they claim was totally not true, but you got to understand, they came into Portland and they took that story of that black guy being killed. They ran this thing on the front page for days and days, and then they got people marching in the street, and then they had the mayor marching in the street. And, you know, if it had been a white kid got killed, it would have been back in the used car section.
Yeah.
You know? And then it became a national deal and everything. In reality, all it was a fight between these three Ethiopians and three white guys. And it had nothing to do really with race. It was a fight over not a parking space, but the blacks had pulled in and were blocking the narrow street, and the whites were trying to get by. And they started mouthing off. And the guy that got killed had already walked up to his house and was going to go in his house, and he ran back to get in the fight. You know. But none of that came out of trial, because they scared those kids that were involved so badly. And the federal government came in and told their attorneys that even if you get a light sentence with the state, we're going to come at you with federal charges and get you for really heavy time. So they pled guilty. You know. One of them still got 40 years. Right? I can't see anybody pleading guilty and getting 40 years.
Yeah.
But anyhow, it was at most a manslaughter situation.
And do you still have like a liens or like
Well, it's pretty hard for him to get blood out of a turnip. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have much. You know, I don't have anything in my name hardly anymore. I'm just I'm like the Catholic priest. I take a vow of poverty. I mean, you get a judgment against people, but any judge will tell you, well, now, if you can collect.
Yeah.
Of course, when they told me $10 million, they might as well have said $2 trillion.
Yeah.
If they'd have said 100,000 or 150,000, I'd say, oh, my, I might be able to do that.
And,
I mean, you see some of the biggest cases in the country have big guys that make a lot of money, even O.J.
Yeah.
I don't think they got him for that much.
No. Yeah.
But it didn't accomplish what they said they was accomplishing. It was, Dee said he's going to build a wall so high between California and Oregon that the Metzgers couldn't get over it.
Mm-hmm.
We had telephone message units going the same week as the end of the trial. I mean, we got people all over that area, and the newspaper goes out. Actually, we never missed a month publishing a newspaper, and Dees is embarrassed by it because he just can't shut me down. He thought I'd make a deal. He offered me a deal.
Mm-hmm.
If you quit this racial movement stuff, if you quit giving speeches, if you quit going on TV and all this kind of stuff, and just go back and do your TV business, you can keep your house and your business. But if you don't, we're going to take it. And I said, well, take it.
The with do you ever have any regrets that you know just if I'd have just you know led a normal life that you know that the things would have been a lot easier?
No, I really don't. I mean, once in a while, I think anybody would think about it just a little bit. But I've had an exciting life. I've had a lot of enjoyment. I've had a supportive family, and I never had the problems that my family a lot of people have had. And I've got friends all over the place. And no, I don't regret anything, really. I regret being naive enough not to have put my house beyond judgment, because the very fact that I didn't do that was because I had never been involved in any illegal activity. And so I said, well, why should I do that if, I mean, there's nothing anybody can charge me with. And so, but I found out that nobody is safe if they really want you. So I think any political activist should not own anything. However, the whole neighborhood I lived in is all Miss Diesel now anyhow. So, however, they made me the block captain to look at, take care of the affairs with the county. And,
really?
And
right.
they interviewed several of them when I was left my house and said, well, I was a good neighbor and like that. There were no houses ever broken into on my block.
And is that how you see the movement these days? Is sort of people here and there that you know that have similar views, and you know, there's really no organization, and it's not so much, you know, that the skinhead movement, if that's what it is, you know, it's not groups here and there, you know, it's more or less just individuals that sort of
that's what
friends with each other. Or?
I promoted it. That's what I promoted was leaderless resistance. during these times of growing government oppression, mm-hmm. Having centralized organizations is foolish. Mm-hmm. Having these meetings where you have agents, an yeah. agent provocateurs,
infiltrating.
And so I said, you know, we will not have membership. Maybe at some time in the future, mm-hmm. and we've told, recommended all membership groups to change their ways, mm-hmm. And so we have associates, independent associates who mm-hmm. choose to network with us, and you know, it's nothing. Nobody has to let blood or take an oath or anything like that. They don't have to buy a uniform. Yeah. And it works great because this allows us to get people into positions that they would never get into if they tried to do it the old way, because they get found out real quick and lose their jobs and everything else because of their beliefs. But now we've got them. This is where you separate the intelligent professional types from the not so intelligent. These are the people that may be working next to you that you'll never know. In fact, they may pretend they're a liberal on the race issue just to throw you off. And we don't recruit cops and things like that. There's plenty of cops that are involved. But we don't want anybody endangering their career, livelihood, whether it be military or police or whatever, by exposing themselves as a, being associated whatsoever. Military people, we tell them, do not have any literature, do not get any racial tattoos. Short, unless an emergency, don't communicate with anybody in the racial movement. But your job is to supply us with information. Important information. They do like to concentrate on the more ignorant actions that some might involve themselves in, which is fine with us. Mm-hmm. They want to make give the impression that we are idiots. That's fine, mm-hmm. because that allows us to operate much more effectively.
And the
see, we use the internet, and of course they're going to try to close that
yeah,
down.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
Oh yeah,
they're going to try and close that down to
sure.
what they call so-called hate groups.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It'll be coming, but that'll be one of the last signs. If they do that, then, as my grandma used to say, Katie bar the door shut, there's a man under the bed. Then if they don't want violence, but they keep doing things to push people towards violence. I've made it very clear over the years, as long as I have free speech, as long as I have access to the public, as long as I have freedom of movement, I'm going to be much less dangerous physically. But if you take away my freedom of speech, my freedom to assemble, and say what I got to say, and like that, then all bets are off. And then you start seeing a whole bunch of Timothy McVeighs.
And so the internet, it's been a very probably low cost, high saturation way to reach a lot of people.
It's true democracy, really, and that's why the governments can't stand it. Most of them, they hate it. They can't. They haven't been able to figure a way of taxing it. They can't keep it out of their countries. So for people who say that democracy is the way to go, that is pure democracy, the internet. And if you, it's like TV or radio. If you don't like it, you don't go to that website. I mean, this nonsense of having to filter stuff is ridiculous. You can put a filter. ADL sells filters. I don't know, $29.95. The kid just goes with his buddy down the street. I mean, you know, nobody, everybody's not going to get them. In fact, they're not going to sell many of them. And we love it when they yell at the kids, oh, don't ever watch this stuff, because that's the first thing they want to see. I've always said if I had the money, I'd create an anti-defamation league. They'd do us so much good.
So, despite all the efforts of ADL and the Klan Watch and all these groups, you know, it's things haven't changed.
No, they haven't changed at all. In fact, if anything, these groups have made people more radical. And also, they, in many cases, overstate the case to make it attractive. I mean, some of the material they send me, they send me stuff. I've seen stuff where I was supposed to be at big meeting someplace, never even was there or something. But anyhow, they make and full color and all this kind of stuff. And you know what? A lot of these young kids in school dig it. Wow, man. You know. But the reason they do it is not so much of protect the public, but they get a lot more contributions. The more severe the problem, they can at least make it look like a severe problem, the more contributions they take in, because Morris Dees in the Southern Poverty Law Center takes in millions and millions. He took in about $7 million off my case in donations. So they don't care about the judgment. When they win these cases, they never get more than peanuts out of people. Their big money, big deals and contributions. They have major fundraising apparatus. Then they get people like Gregory Peck and Walter Mondale, all those people working for them. But if I was a federal agency, I would be really upset with those people. Because not only do they get their intelligence highly inflated, but much of the time it's totally wrong. And
so they're they exaggerate the situation. Too.
Yeah, they have to. You know, they'll count a racial incident. In a lot of cases, just some stupid little thing that really means nothing. I mean, you know, a little fist fight outside a bar or something. Nobody's even really seriously hurt or something. And suddenly, they've got. You know, oh my God, we got hundreds of hate crimes going on. Then they go into school with these programs of teaching tolerance and show all our stuff. Well, there's all we want is a percentage. We don't need everybody. So we get our, you know, we get our 2-3% of the kids that are rebels anyhow, and they say, oh man, that looks pretty good. And it's like a buddy of mine who has been with me a long time. He used to be a Trotskyite when he was a kid. And he said, you know, Tom, he said, I never had anything to do with drugs until they come to the school and start giving us lectures about not taking drugs. And then he got into drugs. So I figured, well, the more they go to the schools and talk about not being a racist, the more kids are going to be finding themselves interested in something they may not even been interested before.
So the
remember the old adage of Jimmy Walker, the mayor of New York? He said, "I was told the press to spell my name."
Oh yeah.
You know, for good or bad, just spell the name right.
So the figures put out by the ADL and all this stuff, they can't believe
they couldn't possibly know, because I don't know. I said, wait a minute, how do you know all this? And I'm right among these people, and I can't tell you how many people are involved. They say, how many? They say they know how many skinheads are involved. Well, hell, the skinheads are running everywhere. You couldn't keep track of them, you know, unless you followed them 24 hours a day. And then you probably couldn't keep track of them.
So have you got any sense as to whether numbers are increasing or decreasing? Or?
I think quality definitely is increasing. I know that.
What do you mean, like quality education level?
Quality education level, and, you know, because I can tell that on the internet. The real, the ones that just aren't going to go anywhere, they stay in one little groove, and that's about it. And a lot of those people, you know, when kids are going through a certain age, they join stuff, and then they get disillusioned and quit. Like this Tom Layden that works for the Simon Wiesenthal Center now. He was one of those guys. And he had some turmoil in his life with his family and stuff, and suddenly he decided to turn the other way and work through the Simon Wiesenthal process. But for every Tom Layden, there's 100 people joining, so we don't worry.
And the so you don't really see like a big resurgence or
not of the basic, like skinheads, but you see, what people don't seem to understand, and I've told them, but a lot of the media don't seem to want to believe me. Several years ago, I started telling these kids to get out of this stuff. Don't do like the old right wing, and don't have these rallies all the time, and don't go around in uniforms. Dress normally, get into college, blah, blah, blah. And they've been doing this. A big percentage of them, and then they're moving out, which I have said, move out into the professions, and keep your ideology, and keep quiet, and like that. And they have done that, and then some in the media say, oh wow, they're disappearing. Well, of course they're disappearing. That's the plan.
So, do you, a lot of your time is spent emailing people? Or?
Yeah, a lot of email.
Would you get like 20 or 30 a day? Or?
Oh, a lot more than that.
Really?
I'd probably get my average about 60 a day anyhow. And of course, my website is linked to other sites too.
And that's resistance.com?
It's www.resist.com. Every week I put a new message on my phone machine, and then one of my young people picks it up and puts it on his website, both in print and in audio, that you can use real audio and listen to it.
Oh, I see.
We've got some real video up there, too. And now I'm putting up a new website that's mm-hmm. going to be really snazzy. And
when's that going to go up?
Any day now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the one that's up there is good.
Yeah.
My son did it, but my son's getting so busy doing other things and putting the paper together that we're bringing some more people on board.
And the with the how many people would you say are how long have you been printing the paper?
Oh, well, see, I started printing the paper back in the late 70s when it was a Klan. And then in 80, we changed to the White American Political Association. And about a year later, we dropped that. We changed it to White Aryan Resistance. We've been putting out a publication for a long time.
So for 20 years?
Yeah.
And without really missing, without interruption.
No, and we've never missed with this paper.
How long has
it
been?
During the trial. Well, let's see. I think around 83, along in there, that's when, of course, when we started our television programming, too, which...
Is that still going on?
Yeah, but not as much. More and more cable companies are putting up roadblocks and getting, or you have to wait forever to get studio time and like that. And it's not as effective medium as we once thought it would be. However, publicity-wise, it did quite well as far as the ADL. All of them going, "Oh my God!"
Like the
they go nuts.
What was it? Was it Geraldo? Was that the show that?
Where
the chair throwing thing?
Well, that's where my Trotskyite buddy broke his nose.
Yeah,
that wasn't no chair. He's embarrassed. There was a chair went flying that went off his shoulder. But if you watch that film carefully, my buddy comes out of the office. He was my son's bodyguard. He was about 275-300 pounds, and he comes plowing like this across the stage, and you'll see him down on this side of the stage Geraldo like that, And then my other friend broke his nose again out in Iowa, John McLaughlin, who's from Illinois. So two friends of mine broke Geraldo's nose twice.
Jeez.
But I was on his show quite a few times.
And
but they've gotten wise. The pressure groups have got to them. They've said, "Well, put on racism, but put on the yokels."
I see. Oh, I see.
Okay, so they're almost out of central casting. If people will come on there representing racial groups I never heard of, and most of them are so stupid that we just sort of grit our teeth. Because they said guys like Metzger and Duke and Matt Hale, now they're putting him on a little more. He's pretty good. These guys are too good. You guys, you know.
They're too articulate.
Yeah, too articulate.
And so how many people would you say you sort of have, like,
influence?
No, that sort of you, like,
work closely?
Yeah, work closely with that in the paper or the internet site.
Well, physically, very few.
You probably don't want to, you probably are slow to trust people.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, you have to be extremely careful, and that's why I have kept a lot of my stuff a family operation. But if someone wants to do work, and we say, okay, try this, and if they do well, they gradually work themselves closer. But the real center core is a very tight circle.
Like 10?
Yeah. I'd say a dozen at the most.
And And you still offer tapes and, you know...
Tapes, videos, hundreds of...
Patches, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The, with, so, our paper, you know, maybe it's just being reactionary. You know, it writes a lot about, you know, the, you know, like you were talking about, the, you know, a fight was of, you know, it was a racial attack,
yeah.
Or, you know, the,
yeah.
These people, like, you know, they get in a fight, you know, and they're skinheads, and, you know,
yeah.
This and that.
Yeah.
In this area, is there, you know, is there much activity around here, or is it compared to other parts of the country?
Well, it's spotty, and you know, I get calls from kids, and I get emails from kids that are in this sort of a traditional skinhead mode,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes they ask for advice and this and that, and I give it to them, and. Sometimes they ask for help, and if I can, I give it to them. Sometimes they ask for papers, and I'll send them some papers. But it's there's sort of a fluid situation of groups, small groups that are in certain areas, you know, maybe San Diego, Poway, different places like that. And but you see, now they made a big deal out of so-called skinheads here at Temecula. I never knew there was a skinhead group in Temecula.
Yeah.
But, and the boys are arrested over there. I did know that one boy, but briefly, because he worked out here on a ranch of a friend of mine. Or he did.
That was Miskum.
Yeah, Danny. And hell, I'd gone out there a couple of times, and he talked to me through the window of the car and said he wanted me to go with him over and ride the bull at the stampede sometime. We keep joking around about that. But, no, these are just fights, and then maybe some racial overtones, but so what? I mean, if there's an assault takes place, then you charge with assault. You know, just charge with hate crime and try to send somebody to prison for 20 years. It's ridiculous. But so much of the time, these white kids are being assaulted, being beaten half to death, and it goes by the wayside. And then if they get in a situation where they can thump somebody, well, then they're hung out to dry.
Mm-hmm.
I was a teenager. We used to have fist fights all the time, you know.
So
I try to steer the kids away from something that's going to get them sent away, because they're no good to themselves or us or anybody else if they get hammered and sent to prison.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the young kids like that, they like to go to these parties and play the music and drink, and sometimes there's even other racial groups there, and then all of a sudden something flares up. And that's why I don't recommend them doing that, but you know how that is, kids. They don't realize it till the cell door clangs shut. But my attackers, they said, oh, you're setting all these guys up to this stuff. That's ridiculous. I always say there's much more clever ways of getting even with somebody than just getting physical.
And that's through, like, sort of, you know, sort of like talking to them and, like, sort of, you know, really showing them more of a racial reality, you know, how things... Really,
I tell them that all the time, and anybody, I'll call in on my telephone line.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about it quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
Whenever they call me, I say, look,
uh-huh.
man, better lay low, be cool, don't make a target out of yourself. But if you can avoid a fight, do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't avoid it, you know, organize, but you got to be very careful. And but like you say, in paper be reactionary. All papers are reactionary.
Yeah.
The more they talk about race and scream about race, the more racism, you know, grows.
Yeah.
I think they say, well, it's that Tom Escher. So they come out with these movies, about Nazis and Klan.
Yeah.
America X movie.
Uh-huh.
I helped make that movie. What's his name? Tony Kay. I've worked with him for a couple of years about projects, and he had I and a bunch of my people come in, and they videotaped and interviewed us for hours to use to train the actors for that movie.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's supposed to be a documentary coming out this fall about that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And but that movie was a recruiting tool. I mean, I could never produce something that would recruit as many people as that film would recruit. Because some people see it some way. But that's a trouble with film. The mop can flop different ways. One person goes to see it and says, racism horrible. And the other person goes and says, yep, that's what we got to do.
You're right.
And the Klan, I think they recruit.
Wasn't there a story in our paper which is not too long ago about, or maybe it was on, I was watching on A&E or something, about how the movie Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
You know, some people see that movie and they're horrified by it, and some kids see it and say, geez, look,
and
you know,
they emulate it.
Yeah, they go out and kill 5 or 6 people, these crime sprees.
That's right.
So, that's a good point.
Yeah, that was a wild movie. They come up with these Klan movies and stuff, and the Nazi, I think those groups recruit people a lot from those movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though they don't mean to.
They don't mean to. They just mean to make money. But I watched the America X, and Norton's a hell of a good actor. Mm-hmm. And every important spot in that movie, every major thing where a guy's making a speech or something, supported our position.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's stealing his truck. Mm-hmm. He's a working guy. In the middle of the night, he goes out and steals his truck. Maybe the bash of the head on the curb was a little overdone, but and then in prison, the way it is, and then the last scene was a message.
Mm-hmm.
When after all this, I won't be a racist anymore and everything else, they blow his brother away.
Yeah.
So to me, there's millions of people out there, young people, going to say, it don't do any good not to try to be, not be a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll still try to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what the reviewers said. They said the strongest positions were actually promoting our cause.
Uh-huh.
Did you see the movie?
You know, I don't know if I did. I don't think I did.
It's in the video store.
Uh-huh. Huh.
And then they made a big deal about how the rest of them in the prison got on this guy because he joked around with the black guy he worked with in the prison. This is all nonsense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I talk to black people all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can go down and have a beer and talk to a black guy. We don't operate like that.
So do you have friends? I mean,
I wouldn't be hypocritical. I don't socialize to the extent of beyond that. I don't invite non-white people to my home because I think that's going overboard. But as far as business and casual conversation and either you like them. A lot of times I like them.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm. But if a lot of times you like them, doesn't that sort of beg the question? I guess if I like them, then they can't be all bad, or maybe it sort of goes back to what Martin Luther King said. Judge me by my character, not by the color of my skin.
Well, I don't look at it as bad or good.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like Nietzsche, beyond good and evil. I look at it generally. We're not talking about, how many white guys are bad, how many black guys are bad. Our thing is separation. We believe generally it's foolhardy to mix the races, and it's going to cause the demise of the white race. Mm-hmm. And so it's a general problem, not so much an individual problem. People use that a lot. Say, well, I know black people are good people. Of course you don't. I've always known black people were good people as far as, I guess, good, you know, they mowed their yard and paid their taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you see your role in the next 10 years or so? You're a national figure now, if you're getting more active internationally and with the internet.
It's going to be interesting how this unfolds, especially my contacts internationally.
Mm-hmm.
How much I can build on that, and as far as political strength, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of, like a football player, I look for an opening and then I go for it. You know? I'm a freewheeling type of person, and I don't work very well in rigid organizations. Mm-hmm. I never did, and I had problems in the right wing that way.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to say, speak from the hip,
mm-hmm.
say what I think,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times that works out very well, and sometimes it gets me in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it depends more on the actions of the government itself, how this goes. If they do like all reactionary systems do, then there's going to be plenty of work for me, because they will continually overreact, and in the quest to repress a few, they'll repress many, and that will create more reaction to them, and gradually there will be not only from our point of view but other points of view, racially and politically and economically, more and more people hating the government, and all systems tend to bring that hatred upon themselves. And there's a lot of dialogue going on the internet right now about coalitions, too, with non-white groups against the government. And this is quite a heated dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
But there's certainly factions out there that are very willing to cooperate with non-white radicals,
mm-hmm.
against the government. I think they have the attitude that... Well, we'll take care of the main problem first, and then we'll figure out the other later. Of course, you know, I met with the Muslims many times, and I gave speeches to the Black Panthers. And I have supported a loose contact, not total... involvement, but communication,
mm-hmm.
and I've shared intelligence information with them that the government had, that I came in contact with.
And the importance of maintaining intelligence, is that to sort of further, you know, monitor the government as it, you know, as it further as people's personal freedoms and rights erode?
Yeah, a lot of this is not even racial. It's simply anti-government. And these, a lot of these other groups that I have contacts with. And there is a astronomical amount of cross-pollination on information about what the government's doing. You got anarchists, you got... I mean, you got so many different groups. You got the libertarian socialists. You got the racial groups. And you got the right wing groups. And you got, I mean, there's just hundreds of them, and they're all out there talking to each other on the net, which is good. And if the government is reviewing a lot of this email, they're probably shitting their pants. There's a lot of areas where we agree with different groups, and then we agree to, you know, we won't talk too much about things we don't agree on. Try to sometimes stress the positive. I have no problem at all with the economic people who are poised against the government. So that is, and also on the ecology end, we move very, very well through that area. A lot of our people are involved in that kind of activity.
So just as I piece this together in my own mind, the way this shapes up is that the there's a need to keep the races separate, or to
maintain
integrity,
control of a white nation. Of some kind,
and and at the same time,
if possible, negotiate. If not possible, warfare.
And overlying all this, the American, which has evolved over the years to more of a remove rights, assaults on personal privacy,
right.
Sort of manipulating the laws in the government's best interest.
Yeah, they use a lot of times us and people, a lot of other people, as an excuse to do what they wanted to do in the first place. I mean, like even with the gun issue, every time they can see somebody go bananas with a gun, they want to pass a new law. And, but I always tell them, here again, the government's shooting itself in the foot, because if they take away all the guns, what do they do in countries where they don't have guns? They throw bombs. They're a lot worse than guns. Anybody, there's enough stuff in this grocery store to blow up half the town.
Yeah, you're right.
And in in the way they want to police the world, they're taking all these young guys out there and they're training them like mad, and then they're coming back with all kinds of skills.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them join us.
Is that their view from the inside is probably no better than, you know, somebody's view from the outside of the system.
I don't quite.
Just because somebody is inside the system, i.e. the military, police officer, or whatever, doesn't mean that their employment or their involvement with the system has endeared themselves to the system.
Not necessarily, no. There's the old adage that the communists used to use. They used to have a deal where a man was assigned to stand on a street corner every day or every week and give out or sell newspapers. And they'd always send somebody to watch and make sure he was there. And they asked, well, why is this so important? And they said, because the same guy could be on the corner with a gun tomorrow. But they must have the discipline to be there at their wherever they're at, no matter what niche they're in. That's their little part of the thing. I make no qualms about it. We will undermine this government if we can. And I may end up in Leavenworth for saying it. It's not legitimate government. People don't understand it. This government is a corrupt front office for the transnational corporations, and that's where I agree totally with the left wing.
20 years ago, if anybody had told you you'd be agreeing with the left wing, what would you have thought?
See, now that was 1979. Well, I was almost ready because by 1980 I was having dialogue with the left wing, and I was doing a lot of left wing things. So in the middle of the 70s.
Yeah.
I would have said they're crazy. But then I, our, you know, a lot of it was caused by the Vietnam War. Guys coming back. I had one really close friend, an operative, who was living up in the mountains in Northern California up there. I don't know, growing pot, I guess. I don't know, Humboldt County up there. And said there was guys, Vietnam vets and stuff, and they was from the right and from the left. And in the wintertime, they'd sit around a fire and they'd be talking politics. Pretty soon, they'd say, "Hey, wait. We're saying almost the same thing. We're just using different words." So we began to see, hey, what is this fighting each other on this? Let's come to some agreement here. So that was the genesis of moving into that kind of activity. Here again, the government shoots itself in the foot. And then, of course, I had studied the economics of international banking and all that. I was into that even before I got into the race thing. So that was, you know, I was a student of Lindbergh Sr. and all the populist leaders and William Jennings Bryan and all the, and then, thanks to some of the people from the left I ran into, I began to really study the evolution of the labor movement in this country. And all that kind of stuff. And then I became a big fan of Jack London. And in fact, I borrow from him. I call the government the Iron Heel. I use that. That's my terms for the government.
And Jack London, the writer.
Yeah.
Call of the Wild.
Yeah, he was very political and very racial. Yeah. He wrote racial books too. And see, the right—I could see the right wing, and the old right wing was still established. I mean, it was still more in the system than where the left wing guys were more out from under the system.
Well, the right wing was always—it was very pro-government.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you—it's easier for me to recruit a left winger. Because usually a lot of left-wingers work harder and they already don't like the government. So all I have to do is get them the race issue to them and it avoids the whole series of education that I'd have to give a left-winger. And an ecologist, it's simple to get a lot of those by pure logic. That if you have a growing population, an overpopulation, your ecology is going to be shot to hell. So why are you allowing the invasion of the millions of people come in this country?
Yeah.
They're going to develop more and more and eat up the open space and destroy the habitat and everything else. So there is a natural affinity, even though a lot of them don't want to admit it, between the ecology movement and the racial movement. Because we just take it one step further into human ecology.
So the... This system, it basically, and it's not just this country, then it's the multinationalist.
It's a club. Mm-hmm. All these countries, the minute the World Bank gets in there and gets their tentacles into these countries, they're through. Mm-hmm. And then they get them so far in debt that they're slaves. And then if they get out of line, they call them rogue nations and send in the military to enforce, you know, their will. Mm-hmm. And by saying, well, they're a threat to our national security.
Mm-hmm. So at some point, it's not just people in this country. It's about everywhere. They'll be sort of fed up at all these... The government is sort of getting out of control.
Well, it's predatory capitalism that just moves in and rapes the nation without any thought for the future. You know, like in the situation here with Puerto Rico. I support an independent Puerto Rico, but I do support the people of Puerto Rico in this country to go back to Puerto Rico, but a free and independent Puerto Rico, and get the Navy. The Navy has... Both ends of the island they're using as gunnery ranges and ripping up and destroying the island. And only the center part is Puerto Rican draft. So So I have sympathy with the Puerto Rican radicals, you know. And that's why I would support Puerto Rican independence. I have sympathy with these separatist causes all over the world. I have sympathy with the radicals in Mexico, too. I gave a speech in the late 70s at the border in English, and I handed it through the fence to the Mexicans in Spanish, saying, don't send all your people up here because you just...